Okay, so this week we are going to be exploring Nachlaot, which, as you can see from our cover photo here, is a colorful neighborhood. It's a colorful neighborhood on a number of levels. It's actually appropriate that we are doing it the week after Purim, because Nachlaot and the whole area of Machaneh Yehuda and the Shushan Purim is wild and busy there. So it's good timing. Nachlaot is kind of this general name for many different neighborhoods. We'll see how many in a minute. It originally starts out as each neighborhood is created in and of itself. This is part of our story, part of the story of moving outside the walls in the late 19th century, right? Jerusalem expansion, and you have a neighborhood that's built, and then another one, and another one. We'll talk about who starts these various neighborhoods. Today, in most cases, it's difficult to tell where one neighborhood ends and another one begins, exceptions being the more ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods, which are a little bit more closed. And they've sort of come to blend together, and also the populations have changed. But they each began as their own distinct entities. Today, Nachlaot is a very interesting spectrum of ethnicities, of the socioeconomic levels. You have people who are students who are renting, who are not particularly wealthy. You have people who are the descendants of the original settlers in the neighborhood who are just holding on to their unrenovated houses. You have people who have bought the unrenovated houses, knocked them down, and built fabulous new houses. So you really have all different kinds of the whole spectrum socioeconomically, from rather poor to rather rich. You have some very interesting institutions and personalities, both in the history of the neighborhood and today. And Nachlaot is really just kind of a fun, fascinating laboratory of a laboratory, but an example of what Yerushalayim has to offer. So without further ado, let us get started. Where are we talking about? Right. So Nachlaot has many different neighborhoods, and you could define it differently. We're gonna broadly define it as the neighborhoods that are between Jaffa Road, right, in the center of town, more or less, and going down all the way to Bezalel. Okay. In the middle, you have the street that is Agrippas, the street that is right off of Machaneh Yehuda Market, which we're going to be talking about also. Most of our neighborhoods that we're talking about are in here, right, between Agrippas and Bezalel. Okay. And like I said, each one is its own separate thing. So you have, for example, Eben Yisrael, which is over here, and Sukkot Shalom, which is over here, and the Knesset neighborhoods down here. And then you even have some neighborhoods that are across Bezalel, right, that are down here in the south. We're not going to go there so much, but we really have a broad range of neighborhoods, and they go more or less all the way out to Ben Tzvi, which is where Gan Sa'akher is. If you're a little familiar with Yerushalayim, this is a nice big public park over here in the west. And in the east, more or less towards King George, a little bit less, right? So we're talking about a large area. And in fact, the local council of Nachlaot is called Lev Ha'ir, the heart of the city, but it's also a pun, not really a pun, it's got double meaning. Lev Lamed Vet, if you do the gematria, right, means 32. Lamed is 30, Vet is 2. Okay, and there are 32 distinct neighborhoods underneath one kind of local city council. And those neighborhoods range from very traditional Sephardim to very secular university students to ultra-Orthodox, Hasidim and non-Hasidim. You really have this very, very broad range of people, and that's complicated, by the way, for the local council to deal with. And like I said, a lot of socioeconomic, interesting, complicated issues, and they really try to bring people together, and we'll see a little bit how as we get started here. Okay, so this is just our range of neighborhoods. We're going to talk about the Machane Yehuda Market, which is basically between Yafo and Agrippas over here. That's going to be part of our story. We'll get to that towards the end. Okay, so that's just to give us a little context where we are. There's also a lot of change that's happening in this neighborhood. Most of the small houses are either staying the same or have been renovated, but there are also some huge skyscrapers and big building projects that are going up on the outskirts of this area, and that's an interesting story in and of itself, maybe for another class. Okay, let's move on. Let's get a little historical perspective. Right? Here's a nice picture of Joppa Road looking towards the Old City, meaning we're in the west, we're looking towards the east, right? Here are the walls of the Old City. Jaffa Gate area, this is from early 20th century, when everything was built up along the walls, which it is not today, right? All these buildings no longer exist. When do we begin to leave the Old City? So we know the story of leaving the Old City, Mishkenot Sha'ananim, right? The first Jewish neighborhood outside the walls. Little by little, more and more neighborhoods. Nachlaot is not the first wave of those neighborhoods, right? It's not Mishkenot Sha'ananim or Nachlat Sheba or even Mea Shearim, but it's the second wave, right? Beginning in the mid-1870s, right? Each neighborhood being built, as we're going to see, as kind of a walled, enclosed neighborhood, because it's still dangerous to be outside the walls. So each one is built as its own unit with walls, with an inner courtyard. The first one is one called Evan Yisrael. Again, Gematria, Evan. Aleph is one, Vet is two, Nun is 50. So 53 houses. Okay, each one has its own, each neighborhood name either has a Tanakh connection or this Gematria connection, all kinds of interesting connections. Eventually, when there are enough neighborhoods outside the walls and enough of this cluster that grows along Jaffa Road, people don't want to go all the way back into the Old City to do their shopping. And that's when we get the beginnings of the Machane Yehuda Market, right? Where people start, Arab farmers from the area, whether it's from Lifta or from Sheikh Badr, right? Agricultural villages very close to the edges of the city as it was then. They start bringing their produce and a market begins to develop. Right. And they are no longer dependent only on the market in the new neighborhood. Okay? The neighborhoods start to grow. They become more and more full, more and more crowded. After 1948, when we have, like we have in so many places, so many new Olim, right? So many new immigrants, no place for them to go. Nachlaot becomes very, very overcrowded because we're talking about relatively cheap central housing. By the 1960s, you have 16,000 residents in these various neighborhoods of Nachlaot. After the Six-Day War, when the city expands, right, and we have new neighborhoods to the north, we have Ramat Eshkol and Pisgat Ze'ev and all those kinds of neighborhoods. The south, Gilo starts to grow. Nachlaot is less popular and it becomes dilapidated. It becomes more filled with crime. And from this peak of the 60s of 16,000 people, by 1988, we are a quarter of that number, 4,500 people. In the 80s and in the 90s, there's a turnaround, right? The local government starts to improve things. There's money for renovation. There's money for planning. And today the numbers are up. They're nowhere near that height that they were in the 60s, which is good because that was overcrowded. Today we have about 7,000 people living in Nachlaot. The renaissance of Nachlaot and also the renaissance of Machane Yehuda. We'll get to the renaissance of Machane Yehuda as we go on. So that's just to keep in mind that the neighborhood begins as just a place to go outside the walls, but it has ups and downs based on what else is going on in Jerusalem at the time. Okay, in the beginning, right, what are the needs of each of these neighborhoods? So we are looking here at the two pictures here are from the neighborhood I mentioned before, Evan Yisrael, which is kind of at the eastern edge of Nachlaot. I want to go back. Right, Evan Yisrael is right about here, right off of Agrippa's near Jaffa, right? It's one of the first ones, and it's a great example of how these neighborhoods were built, right? If we're talking about a time period, we're in the 1880s, 1890s, right? You are worried about security because there's not so much outside the walls. Why do people not want to leave the walls? Because of the walls, right? You want to be inside the security of the closed spaces, of the gates that are locked at night. And when you move outside the walls, you're suddenly vulnerable to bandits, to wild animals, to all sorts of things. So the way these first neighborhoods are built is that the houses themselves create a wall, right? They are built as a square or as a rectangle, with the open space being in the middle, with a courtyard in the middle, right? The courtyard is useful for all sorts of things. First of all, because you need to have some open space to have some fresh air, but also because these houses are mostly very small, right? They're usually two rooms, three rooms. You have very little space. So you do your cooking outside and your laundry outside. And of course, you do your socializing outside. Before Machane Yehuda Market is built, you have peddlers who are coming in and out. But the neighborhood is built as an enclosed area. You can see over here in this picture on the left, you have a gate, right? You have gates at the different ends that are closed. It's only about 30 years after these, 20 years after these neighborhoods are being built, that you have a new concept that are called guard neighborhoods, right? Neighborhoods like Rehavia and Talpiot, where now so many more people have moved outside of the walls that it becomes safer. And you can have a neighborhood that's not a fortress. But these early neighborhoods are basically fortresses with everything that you need in the courtyard, and nobody needs to go outside, right? You have your cistern with water. That's the picture here on the left. You have a communal oven. No, that's so easy to see in this picture. None of those communal ovens are used anymore. This is in the Bate Broida neighborhood. This is the communal oven, which has been sealed up, but this used to be the oven for everybody, not for bread. For bread, you would take your bread to be baked at the local baker, which I always love that story right here are these very, very religious Jews, but nobody has any issue with baking their bread in the baker's oven. The baker has no issue with people bringing their bread to be baked in the oven, right? That everybody trusts everybody. So what's the oven for if you're not baking your bread in it? What's the oven for is very important. You need a place to put your cholent, right? You need to cook on Friday night, your chamin. So you put it in the oven, and it cooks there all Friday night. So everybody in the neighborhood is using this communal oven, and I will just let you imagine, for those of you who make cholent, right, how good it smells when you wake up Shabbos morning and that cholent. Imagine 30 cholents, right, all cooking together. So that's what's going on here. So you have cisterns, you have ovens. You obviously have a synagogue in this small area, and you have, in the days before the market, or even when the market is around, peddlers who are coming through the neighborhood, right? The gates are open during the day, and the fruit and vegetable guy comes through the neighborhood, and the baker comes through the neighborhood, and the guy who's selling old clothes comes through the neighborhood, because this is just the way things are. There's not so much of a public space outside. So let's talk a little about who's building these neighborhoods, right? We have different types of neighborhoods. So one type of neighborhood is a neighborhood that's built by philanthropists, right? You have wealthy people. Often these are wealthy childless couples. And this is a great example of one of them. I'll show you, explain to you the dedication in a minute. This is Bate Broida. Infertility is, of course, an issue still today, but today there are many ways to try and solve it. Doesn't always work, but there are many possibilities. In the 19th century, if you can't have children, you can't have children. That's it. And so couples who couldn't have children but who did have money, and the most famous one are the Montefiores, we'll talk about them in a minute, they would do things to carry their name forward. And one of the ways you could do that, certainly in Jerusalem, was to build a neighborhood. Why? Because A, you're putting your name on the neighborhood, right? And that's what you have here, Ohalei Yaakov, named after the founder, Yaakov Yosef Broida. But the other thing, and the much more significant thing, is you give these houses for free to whoever wants to move in there, but as a condition, you build them also a shul in the neighborhood, and as a condition to living there, you have on your yard site every year people who are saying Kaddish for you. So it's a fascinating trade-off, right? People who have families, have children, can now have a place to live because they don't have any money, whereas the childless people have somebody who's going to say Kaddish for them. And this neighborhood of Ohel Yaakov, you can't see it so clearly in the picture. If you go walk around the Nachlaot, you could see very nicely on the inscription. It's an inscription from the book of Isaiah, famous pasuk, because we use it for the Holocaust Museum. Benatati lahem v'beiti u'bchomotai yad v'shem tov mibanim u'banot. And I'm going to give them within my walls a name and a monument that is better than children, right? That's basically code word for saying you can't have children, but this is going to be instead of having children. So we have philanthropists who are doing this kind of building. What's this? Can't see something on the edge of the map. I'm sorry. I don't know if that's, I think that must be your screen. I don't know if that's a problem for everybody. But I hope it is not. People can tell me. Moses Montefiore, okay, probably our most famous philanthropist, certainly in Jerusalem, is Moses Montefiore. Moses Montefiore is the one who is responsible for this whole story by coming in the 1850s and saying, I'm going to build the first Jewish neighborhood outside the walls, Mishkenot Sha'anim. It takes a couple of years to take off, but it becomes the impetus for people to have the courage to move outside. Moses Montefiore and his wife Judith, who doesn't get remembered as much, were very, very interesting people, very significant philanthropists. He was a Sephardi Jew, born in Italy, but his parents came to live in England. She was connected to the Rothschild family, Ashkenazi Jew. Their marriage was somewhat scandalous because Sephardim marrying Ashkenazim, why? Not so good. But clearly it went okay. And he was so successful as a stockbroker. He went into business with his brother-in-law, Rothschild family. He was so successful but that by the time he was in his 40s, he was able to retire. He lived a very long life. He lived till he was 101 years old. And he basically spent his life protecting Jewish communities all over the world. And him and his wife's special project was the land of Israel, and particularly Jerusalem. Okay. 19th century, they take 7 trips to Jerusalem from England. Okay. Not so simple in those days, but they have their carriage, a famous song by Yoram Gaon about Montefiore getting onto his carriage and the angel of death keeps coming and saying, it's time to go. It's time. No, can't go yet. Gotta help the Jews here. Gotta help the Jews there. And they did many things to help the Jews of Jerusalem. Not all of them were successful. He wanted to create a hospital. The Jews of Jerusalem didn't listen to him. He wanted to give them a railroad. He wasn't the one who was able to do it. But he did start this push outside the walls. And there are 5 neighborhoods that are named for Moses Montefiore, besides the one that he actually built, Mishkenot Sha'anim. 2 of them are in Nachlaot. One is called Mezkeret Moshe. And that's a Sephardic neighborhood, and the other is called Ohel Moshe. Today they're mixed up, but originally that's how they started. Ohel Moshe, which was an Ashkenazi neighborhood, and they are really the most famous of the philanthropists. Okay, let's go on. We don't have only philanthropists. Okay, we also have community organizations. Okay, when you walk around in Nachlaot, again, it's a little harder to see today, except in the Haredi neighborhoods, but most of the neighborhoods had a very specific ethnicity. Okay, they were Sephardim, they were Ashkenazim, they were Yemenites, they were Greek Jews, whatever they were. And you had community organizations who were involved in buying the land and in building them. Okay, one of those very famous organizations was, it's called the Vaad HaKlali Knesset Yisrael. Okay, this is the Ashkenazi communal organization led by Rav Shmuel Salant, who you're seeing here, his picture. Rav Shmuel Salant was the legendary rabbi of Jerusalem, Ashkenazi rabbi of Jerusalem. He made Aliyah in 1841. He was a 25-year-old, very young man. The Ashkenazi community of Jerusalem in the 1840s was numbered in the hundreds, very, very few people. He became the chief rabbi. He lived till 1909, stayed the chief rabbi of the Ashkenazim all that time. By the time of his death, you had thousands, more than 10,000 Ashkenazi Jews in Jerusalem, and he presided over that growth. And he, as much as he looks like an extremely traditional person, and all his life he lived in a small apartment near the Chorva Synagogue in the Old City, but he was involved in incredible progress for the Jews of Jerusalem. He starts the Bikur Cholim Hospital. He institutes universal education, okay, before Rav Salant. Everybody who was educated in Jerusalem, you got a basic, you learned how to read and write, but very soon you were sent off to work. Rav Salant instituted universal education for everybody, as well as a universal tax for everybody to pay for it. Okay. And he spearheaded buying land to build three neighborhoods, Knesset Aleph, Knesset Bet, Knesset Gimel. Rav Salant was known not just for his piety and for his knowledge, but also for what we call in Hebrew Seichel Yashar, right? He had a lot of common sense. One of my favorite stories about him is, you know, he would sit in his Beit Midrash, in his little community near his little apartment near the Chorva. His students would come and learn with him, and people would come and ask him questions. And one day, a woman comes in. She's very distraught. We're cooking for a feast, for a wedding, and we have this big pot of chicken soup, and by accident, somebody knocked a jug of milk into the pot. What do we do? Hey, now, if you know a little about kosher, you know that it's a question of proportions, right? It's called batel b'shishim. If you have 60 times as much of the main thing, right, in this case the soup, as the minor thing, in this case the milk, that's okay. But if the proportions are any less, right, only 50 times as much, then that's too bad, and it's all treif. So Rav Salant says, okay, how big is the pot? How big was the jug? And it seems like no way out here. They're going to have to throw out this pot of soup. But he says, you know what? Come back in an hour, and I'll give you an answer. Fine. Go away. Come back in an hour. Rav Salant says, it's okay. You can eat the soup. It's fine. It's not a problem. And everybody's very astonished, but he won't explain. And it only comes out years later. There was only one milkman who delivered milk to the Jewish families in Jerusalem. And Rav Salant summoned him, and he said, listen, I promise I'm not going to tell anybody else, but just between the two of us, how much do you water down your milk? Right. And that, of course, enabled him to make the soup be kosher, because most of it was water and it wasn't milk. Okay, so Rav Salant, behind the building of the neighborhoods of Knesset, okay, other community buildings, communities are not necessarily from the money of the community, right? So a very famous example are the Yemenite Jews. Yemenite Jews come to Jerusalem in 1882. When they come, they are basically disavowed by both the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. Nobody's helping them. They look like Arabs. They speak Arabic. Everybody's a little suspicious. Who are you? We've never heard of you before. We've never seen you before. And the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim refuse to help them. The only people who are willing to help these Yemenites, who are so down and out that they have to move into burial caves on the edges of the Arab neighborhood of Silwan, the only people who are willing to help them are the Christians of something called the American Colony, who, you know, are very taken by them. They feel like they look like biblical Jews. They say they must be from the tribe of Gad, and they offer them charity and they offer them food. And when it gets out that the only people helping are a Christian organization, then the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim are very embarrassed, and they decide that they're going to help them. And they buy some land for a neighborhood, but it's very little bit of land. There's only enough room for 13 houses, one of which is going to be a shul. So they decide that they're going to have a lottery, and each resident can live in each lucky one who wins the lottery can live in the apartment for 2 years, and then they have to move on and give it to someone else. So this neighborhood is called Hagoral, right? Hagoral as in a lottery, just like we had on Purim. So that's another community organization. And one more different type of community. Okay, this is not from a communal leader here who's raising money, and it's not, you know, a group that buys land and gives it to the community. This is from a communal leader from abroad. Okay, we have a few Hasidic small communities in Nachlaot. Okay, one is called Batei Rand. That was a philanthropist. This is another one. This is called Batei Munkach. People who know a little bit about European Jewish history know that Munkács was a large city in Hungary that had Hasidic Jews, that had not Hasidic religious Jews, that had secular Jews, a lot of Zionists. And in 1914, the leader of the Munkács community, Admor, buys land. He's very messianic. He buys the land in 1914, believing that this is like a step towards the redemption. He only comes to visit the land of Israel in 1930. And that's when they start to build this neighborhood. We say neighborhood, it's tiny, right? It's like not even 10 houses. And today it's still a self-contained neighborhood. You can't sell to anyone who is not Haredi. It's very small. You have to daven in the shul there. It's kept its character, unlike many of the other neighborhoods in Nachlaot. So the ultra-Orthodox communities really kept their character much more than the others, because they were unwilling to sell to outsiders. They wanted to keep the neighborhood the way that it was. And here you have a great picture of it on Sukkot, right, with the sukkahs in the courtyard. Nachlaot has groups from all over, right? It really has an ingathering of the exiles, the kibbutz galiot, and different groups living next to each other. I will tell a probably way too apt joke from a comedian here named Jackie Levy, who said, you know, the neighborhoods here, all these different ethnicities, they live together like brothers, like Cain and Abel. All right, which is a great line. I will not take it for myself. They didn't always get along, but we really do have so many different types of communities that today Israel is, I won't say completely a melting pot. You definitely have different ethnicities and distinctive identities, but a lot of the real differences have kind of melted away in this kind of mosaic of Israel. But 100 years ago, the groups had much more of distinctive identity. So here are two that you really don't hear about very much. On the left here, you have the Beit Knesset, Beit Talmud Torah, La'adat Ha'ur Palim B'Yerushalayim. Okay, the Ur Palim were Jews from Turkey. And this is actually given by the Mukhtar, Shabbat, Shabtai Yaakov, the Mukhtar. Mukhtar is the leader of the community. Ba'abud Yosef Abada. Okay, Abada is one of the major families there. These are Turkish Jews, Ur Palim, maybe from the language of Ur Kasdim, like where Avram comes from. They were very poor and very strong. They had a reputation for being real strong men. They worked as porters and as builders and as guards. And this particular family, the Abada family, they were known as Abadim. They were the strong men. They protected from Arab marauders. They were very tough. They were heavy drinkers. They were like real... tough cookies that you wouldn't want to run into in a dark alley in the middle of the night. But very interesting characters. On the right is a very different kind of a community. Right? If you look, you see Beit HaKnesset, Beit Avram, Ba'ol Sara. I didn't bring you the right sign. I apologize. There's another sign that has the name, and it says Yehudei Yanina. Yanina is very interesting. I don't know if we have any listeners here from New York. There are very few Yanina communities. One of the few is on the Lower East Side in New York City. Who's Yanina? So Yanina is in Greece. And there are Greek Jews. Unfortunately, much of the Greek Jewish community, particularly the Salonika community, was decimated in the Holocaust. The ones who survived were the ones who came to Israel. They were brought to Israel to be porters in Haifa in the 1930s. But most of the Greek Jews became sort of Spartic, right? What happened? Jews are expelled from Spain. They go to Turkey. They go to Greece, right? These are some of the countries that accept them, the Ottoman Empire, basically. And these Sephardic Jews kind of overrun the local community. Greek Jews had their own way of praying, their own way of reading the Torah. It's called Romaniot, their own customs. But they all sort of became Sparty because there were so many Sparty, and there were very few communities that kept up these old traditions of the Romani of Jews. And one of these places is Yanina. So it's one of the few places where we still have the traditions of the original Greek Nusach, the original way of praying that the Greeks did before the Sephardim came. So you have one shul on Lower East Side, and one in Nachlaot. Somebody told me somewhere else. I don't remember. I don't know if anybody here knows and wants to write it in the chat. There is another place, but in Nachlaot, you can come and hear them. Okay, a neighborhood, style of neighborhood that we don't usually, list when we say who are the neighborhood builders, right? We like to say philanthropists and businessmen and community leaders. We don't usually like to say squatters, but there are squatters. Okay, so this is a neighborhood that is called, basically, I guess you could translate it as Tin Pan Alley. It's called Shkunat HaPachim, right? A pach is like a can, basically. And these were shacks that were covered over with this kind of tin, sometimes even with corrugated cardboard. You could see very, very, very poor. Where do these guys come from, and why are they building these like very makeshift neighborhoods? So in 1890, the land near Mishkenot Sha'ananim, was given by Moses Montefiore, who was already passed away, but he had given it in his will as land for the poor. But Montefiore's nephew, Yosef Montefiore, kicks them out. The Sephardim have nowhere to go. The Ashkenazim go to the Katamonim. But the Sephardim come here and they make their houses out of shell oil containers. That's basically what this is. Basically, whenever there were new immigrants that came that had no money, they ended up in this Shchunat HaPachim. So you had Yemenites and you had Persians and you had Kurdish Jews. Little by little, they would gather money. What's the first thing they would always build? Synagogue, right? The synagogue is always what you want to build first. And they would scrape their money together in order to be able to build a synagogue. Today, a lot of this is gone, but you can still wander around this neighborhood, which is kind of at the western edge of Nachlaot, and see some of these still really old falling apart houses. Fortunately, most of them have been renovated, but this is another style of neighborhood. Nachlaot has literally dozens of synagogues. I was just reading something today about claims in Second Temple times or after of like huge numbers and dozens of synagogues in Jerusalem. And the author was writing about how, that sounds very unlikely, but really think about Jerusalem today, where we literally, there are hundreds of synagogues. And Nachlaot is an incredible concentration. Walk a half a block, you'll get to another shul. And of so many different edot, so many different types of communities, types of davening, ranging all the way from the Romanio Jews that we just mentioned, up to like Karlbach, Neo-Hasidic, and everything in between. So we're going to highlight a couple of interesting communities and synagogues. So this one is, as you can see in the sign, perhaps the Great Synagogue Ades of the glorious Aleppo community. Okay, Aleppo or Aram Tsoba or Chaleb, they're all the same place. Some people know about Chalabi Jews, right? That's another name for the Syrian Jews. A lot of Chalabi Jews who came to New York or to LA, but there was also migration that came to Jerusalem in the late 19th century. The Addis family was a large and a wealthy family. They went to Israel, but they also went to Egypt and to Turkey and to Baghdad. And the ones who came to Jerusalem built this beautiful synagogue. And you can see here Yosef Addis and Ovadia Addis. They are from the founders, 1901. They built it. The shul was damaged in World War I and again in 1948, and in 1967 it was used as a shelter during the Six-Day War. In 2000, the community gave money and redid the inside with beautiful, fixed up the wall paintings inside. The community of Aram Tsoba or of Aleppo, is famous for its great synagogue and, of course, for what was kept there, and that's the Aleppo Codex. So just to briefly tell the story, we could do a whole class just on the story. The great synagogue of Aleppo, and anyone who is in Israel, visiting Israel or living in Israel, you can go to the Israel Museum now, and there's actually amazing virtual reality that you can see based on photographs that were taken and smuggled out of the synagogue. It was very dangerous to take these photographs. They were smuggled out of the synagogue, black and white photographs. They created a virtual reality movie that's like walking through the synagogue, and it's incredible. So if you have an opportunity to see it, go see it. It's really cool. So the Great Synagogue, the Aleppo community traces its roots back to the time of King David. Okay, King David's general Yoav, we hear in Tanakh that he conquers all the way up to Aram Tzoba. So they trace the community back to them. Does it go back to First Temple time? Maybe the community seems to at least go back to Second Temple times. It's definitely in a very strategic, important location for trade. There were a lot of great scholars that came from Aram Tzoba. And this is the Great Synagogue, which had inside a courtyard. Now the Codex, which you can see a page from over here on the right, Codex is its own fascinating story. This is, well, today I just found out that this is actually not the oldest written text of the full Tanakh, right? This is not the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is about 1,000 years after the Dead Sea Scrolls, okay? But it's not a scroll. It's a codex. It's a book of Tanakh that was written in Tiberias. It used to be thought of as the oldest, except for the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not. Today we know it's the Sassoon Codex, which is, okay, it's maybe like a couple decades older. So this is still pretty hot stuff. This was written in Tiberias by the Masoretes, the guys who come up with vowelization and with ta'amim, right, with the notes. So it's known, it's considered to be one of the most correct writings down of the Tanakh. It's written in Tiberias for a very wealthy guy. It somehow ends up in Jerusalem. It's captured by the Crusaders. It's ransomed by the Jewish community in Egypt. Maimonides talks about looking at it in order to write his own Sefer Torah. Somehow, we don't know all the steps. It ends up in Aleppo. Okay? It ends up in Aleppo, and the synagogue takes it and keeps it safe, basically in the basement. It's not used. It's kept, it's used. They check when there are questions about Masorah, about are we writing things the correct way, but mostly it's kept almost as a talisman. It's kept in the shul, but nobody's allowed to touch it. It's very rare that they take it out. In the 1850s, a scholar named Shalom Yelin sends his son-in-law, Moshe Kimchi, to get permission to copy information out of it. He writes this, it's also a great story, he writes the things that he found in the codex in the margins of a Tanakh that was then found a century later by somebody named Yossi Ofer. Today the Tanakh that Reb Breuer's Tanakh is based on the codex. A lot of amazing stuff. Basically, when Israel is declared state, the synagogue in Aleppo is attacked. There's a fire. The codex is smuggled out, but a large part of it is missing. And if you're fascinated by the story, Matti Friedman wrote a great book called, not excitingly, The Aleppo Codex, but it's a really good book about what happened to it and where pieces that are not in the state of Israel have gone. But let's get back to Nachlaot. So this is the inside of the synagogue. Very, very beautiful. Mother of pearl brought from Syria in 1913. Right, the synagogue is only around for a dozen years by that point. They commission an artist named Yaakov Struck, who's from Bezalel, right? The very beginnings of the art school in Israel. And they commission him to do wall paintings of the different tribes. Very, very beautiful. He unfortunately dies 2 years later of typhus. The wall paintings fade, but then they were redone when the synagogue was renovated in 2000. The Ada Synagogue has the distinction of being, you know, the Sfardim say Slichot already from the beginning of Elul, from Rosh Chodesh Elul. And the Ada Synagogue is a place where the first slichot are televised always every year. It's a very big deal. People come and all the kids are like a choir, and it's a very special place. It's a very beautiful shul. Another fascinating shul is this one, Chesed V'Rachamim. What am I writing here in the title? If you look, I don't know how people can see well enough, but underneath the picture on the left, you have the title of the synagogue, the name of the synagogue, Agudat Beit HaKnesset Chesed V'Rachamim, right? That's the name of the shul, Chesed V'Rachamim. La'adat HaSfaradim, for the Sephardic Edah. And then in parentheses, you have the initials Samech Tet. And what's the Samech Tech? Meyotzei Ir Atika B'Yerushalayim Nosad Tafresh Pei Hei, right? 1925. What is the Samech Tet? Samech Tet is a very prestigious way to sign your name. It means Sfaradi Tahor. You are a pure Sfaradi, meaning you can trace your lineage back to the exile from Spain in 1492, or the exile from Portugal, or the forced Christianization, the forced conversion in Portugal in 1497, right? But you can trace yourself back to that community, and that was considered to be a real mark of distinction. If you wanted to be from the aristocracy in Jerusalem 100 years ago, you were definitely not Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim were the poor come lately cousins. The aristocracy were the Sephardim. So to be able to write that you are a Sfaradi Tahor, that's a very, very big deal. Hey, this is an interesting synagogue. This was founded by merchants, butchers in the Machane Yehuda markets, very close to the market. The building was existing already. They didn't build the building. The building was existing, and it was a bar and a nightclub. And these guys, butchers, hardworking, God-fearing, wake up early. They didn't like this bar in their neighborhood. So they bought the building and they turned it into a shul. And it's actually a really beautiful shul, both from the outside and the inside. On the outside, you can see the door on the right here is all the symbols of the tribes. And on the left, there's a special door with the Eshet Chayil on it, right? Woman of Valor, because this, of course, is the entrance to the women's section. And inside, you have paintings on the walls. So very, very beautiful, very elaborate shul. And one more interesting shul, kind of on the outskirts of Nachlaot. I don't think it really counts as Nachlaot. It's on Rehov Yafo, across from Machane Yehuda, is what's called the Zohari HaChama, which means the rays of the sun. It's called that, of course, because of its sundial. Right. Take a look at the sundial. The picture on the right here is a picture from today, or I don't know, 5 years ago. The picture on the left is much older. There was a tower on the top floor, which no longer exists, but the sundial is still around. Right. You have a sundial, and today you also have two clocks. One is European time, like we tell time, and one is called Sha'on Eretz Yisrael. It's also called an Arabic clock. 12 o'clock is sundown. Right? That's how they count time. Why the sundial? Why the clocks? What's the big obsession with time? So the building was built by an American Jew, beginning of the 20th century, 1905. There's a tailor named Samuel Levy, who did well for himself in the Golden and Medina. And then he makes Aliyah and he comes to Israel and he sees that there are a lot of poor immigrants who have no place to stay. So he builds this building and it's really the first skyscraper, right? Take a look at it. It's 1, 2, 3, 4 stories with this cupola or whatever it's called, widow's walk on the top. So it's a very big building and he builds it for these new immigrants to have a place to stay. Okay. But he also builds a shul and he is very, very into the idea of praying with sunrise, right? Vatikin. So he wants to have the tower so you can see when the sun is coming up. And eventually they put the sundial up to know what time, to be able to really know exactly when is Vatikin. It was used, this shul, we have an interesting newspaper article, every 28 years we have this very unusual thing called Birkat HaChama, where we bless the sun. And we have a newspaper article from when this was in the 80s, I think, the last one, the one before the last one, talks about going up to the roof to this whole community and saying the Birkat HaChama together. Sundials are an interesting thing. It takes skills to know how to make a sundial and to know how to make it precisely, not so simple. This is the Zohar HaChama one on the left. On the right is another sundial, much smaller one, in the shul in the Gra shul in Shaarei Chesed. Both of them are made by a Jew named Moshe Shapira. He was self-taught sundial maker. Of course, knowing when the sun rises and knowing what time it is and when the sun sets, very important for Jews for prayer, even more important perhaps for Muslims, because they have very precise times of prayer. And Moshe Shapira's skill as a sundial maker got outward, got out. The Mufti, the Muslim religious authority in Jerusalem, wanted him to build a sundial on the Temple Mount. And he didn't want to. He didn't believe the Jews should go up on the Temple Mount. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so he did what a lot of business people do when they are offered a job that they don't really want. He gave them a very, very high price, hoping that they would back down. They would say, "Well, we're not so interested." They didn't back down. They said, "We'll pay whatever you want, whatever you want." And he still didn't want to do it. And he was worried that they would come after him. And he actually ran away from the city. He exiled himself from Jerusalem just so that he wouldn't have to build this sundial. So that's Moshe Shapira. Okay, a few personalities in Nachlaot. One of my favorite Nachlaot personalities is Rav Aryeh Levin. Hey, Rav Aryeh Levin, who you can see here on a stamp. You can also see him on a large graffiti that went up in Nachlaot a few years ago. Rav Aryeh Levin was from Eastern Europe. Was born in 1885. He makes Aliyah as a young man. Penniless, he really had nothing. At first, he studied in the yeshiva in Slutsk. We're gonna hear about his Rosh Yeshiva in a minute. And then he comes to Israel. He gets married. He becomes a teacher in the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. But he's perhaps best known for his for being what's called the rabbi of the prisoners. He became the rabbi who would go to the British prison at the end of Jaffa Road, and he would visit the prisoners. And of course, in the 1940s, many of the prisoners were members of the underground movements of the Haganah, of the Etzel, of the Lehi, and he was very connected to them, very involved with them. When he died in 1969, everybody from Menachem Begin on down came to his funeral. He was a very, very beloved personality who, besides taking care of the prisoners, he took care of his students. He really was a genius of chesed, as his biographer, Rav Simcha Raz, writes about him. One story about him is, he taught in the school, in the junior high school of Eitz Chaim, of the yeshiva. And he taught boys who were of bar mitzvah age. And he noticed that, every time there was a bar mitzvah, the boys would get up a collection and they would buy a set of books for the bar mitzvah boy. And he noticed that one boy's bar mitzvah was coming up and nobody was collecting. And he called over one of the leaders in the class. He said, "What's happening? Why aren't you collecting for his bar mitzvah?" They said, "Well, he has no money, so he never gives to us, so we're not buying for him." So Rabbi Levine says, "Go to my house. Go tell my wife to give you the new set of chumashim that my son just got for his bar mitzvah. Bring it back here." He brought it back. He said, "You're now going to inscribe it from the whole class to this boy," right? And that's Rav Aryeh. He was very much involved with the great people, but very much involved with the small people as well. The yeshiva that he taught in, Eitz Chaim, was originally in the Old City. Rav Salant was the one who founded it. They built this large building on Jaffa Road, which today is being turned into a whole apartment complex, the whole story. They got money to support the yeshiva by having stores. They owned this whole area on the front of Jaffa Road, so they had stores, and the profit would go to the yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva of Eitz Chaim was the gentleman on the right here, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who was a brilliant scholar in Volozhin in Eastern Europe. He was the Rosh Yeshiva in Slutsk, right? His students among them were Rav Arya Levine, Rav Menachem Shach, Rav Moshe Feinstein, right? Really great names. 1925, he comes to Jerusalem and he also lives in Nachlaot. Just one story about him. He came to give his shiur, right? He taught the older boys and he came to give his Gemara class. And he noticed that in the sitting in the auditorium where he taught was one of the wealthy men of Jerusalem. And he was kind of surprised that he was there, but he went and he started to teach. And suddenly this young man who really had never spoken before in his classes, he's like frantically waving his hand and Rav Meltzer calls on him and he says, yes. And he says, he asks him a question on the Gemara that Rav Meltzer is teaching. And Rav Meltzer stops, he pulls his beard, he scratches his head, he looks in this book, he looks in that book. After 5 minutes of hemming and hawing, he slams his Gemara shut. He says, that's it. Everything I had planned to teach today, this question has just taken everything apart from me, and I have to spend time now studying and redoing my shiur. So everybody is dismissed. We'll meet after lunch. And everyone starts filing out. And another of the students in the class, somebody who really was a very good student and who always talked, he came running up. He said, Rebbe, Rebbe, I know the answer to the question and I can solve it for you. He says, I know the answer too. But for this boy to be able to impress his future father-in-law who's checking him out, that's a little more important. The answer to the question can wait until after lunch, but the shidduch we're not going to ruin. So that's a story about Ravitzer Zalman Meltzer. Somebody else who lived in Nachlaot was Yitzhak Navon, who was the fifth president of Israel and the first president to come from a Sephardic background. They came to Jerusalem from Turkey in the 17th century, originally coming from Spain. And he wrote a musical called Habustan Hasfaradi, The Spanish Garden, all about his upbringing in Nachlaot. And another very famous Nachlaot family are the Banai family. If you know anything about Israeli music, you know some Banai, right? Whether it's Meir Banai or Ehud Banai or Evyatar Banai or Orna Banai, who's not a musician, she's an actress and a comedian. There are so many Banais. They are an incredibly, ridiculously talented family. The patriarch was, of the family was Eliyahu Meir Banai, and they had a house on Rehov HaAgas in the Machane Yehuda market. He didn't make his living doing music. That was definitely not something that people did in those days. But he was a storyteller, and the Banai family came from Shiraz in Persia, which was a community that had a very strong tradition of song. A few years ago. 2 years ago, last year, the Tower of David Museum did an exhibit on the Banais, and that's where this great picture is from of the brothers, the cousins. And they have become an empire of entertainment in Israel, but they started out in Machane Yehuda. Okay, a couple of institutions that are in the neighborhood. One of them is the Allianz School. The Allianz Israelite Universelle was a French organization. In Hebrew, it's called Kol Yisrael Chaverim or Kiach. They helped Jews all over the world. They were not Zionists. They were a Jewish philanthropic organization, and they started schools in all sorts of places. And in 1880, they built a building in Jerusalem that was called Merkaz Torah Umilacha. The idea was to teach Jewish children a trade, to teach them languages, some Torah. The building, which was a beautiful, impressive building, was sold. It stopped being used as a school already in the 20s. Schools in different places. It was sold in 1970 to an organization called Chevrat Klal, who tore down the building and left just the gate, as you can see here on the left. And they built what is known as one of the worst buildings in Jerusalem, and that's called Binyan Klal, which is a maze and a disaster, but has a lot of interesting urban renewal going on there. That's a subject for another class. But the destruction of the Allianz, and the only thing they left behind was the gate, led to an outcry about preservation in Jerusalem. And today, There has to be at least lip service that's paid to preservation. And another school of the Alliance, the girls' school, which is today in the middle of the Machane Yehuda parking lot, is surrounded by huge development, but the building is slated for preservation and is going to be kept in its original form, but turned into a hotel. So today there's all kinds of interesting stuff that's going on. Finally, hope we've gotten hungry. Oh, no, not yet. We're going to get to the shuk in 1 minute. Shaare Tzedek. Shaare Tzedek Hospital, which today is a huge modern hospital on the western side of the city, but it begins on Rehov Yafo, very far down, right? In 1890, the land is bought there by the real spirit of the hospital, Dr. Moshe Wallach. And he buys land all the way at the edge of Jaffa Road, and people think he's crazy. Like, what are you buying all the way down there? Who's going to come to your hospital? But it became, of course, a very, very important hospital. Moshe Wallach was so identified with this hospital that most people do not call it Shaare Tzedek; they call it Dr. Wallach's Hospital. He instituted religious halachic law in the hospital, which is still how Shaare Tzedek is run today. He was completely devoted to this institution. He never married. He didn't allow his nurses to marry either. He's actually buried in right outside the hospital. There's an old cemetery from the 1950s. Shvester Selma was this very, also very mythological nurse who was very, very involved in the hospital. The Shaare Tzedek building was moved. They didn't move the building. They moved the institution to the area of Beit Vegan in the 1980s. And the old historic building for a while was part of the Rishon HaShidur, the broadcast authority. Today, again, is part of a very interesting development project. Today, there are a lot of startups and artist co-ops that are there, and there's an art gallery, and transformations. And the shuk, how could we not talk about the shuk? So in 1887, there's a neighborhood that's called Machane Yehuda that's built by various investors, among them Yosef Navon. And there's kind of an impromptu market, right? Like we said, Arabs who are from the agricultural villages nearby, but it's a big mess and it's not hygienic. Along come the British in the 1920s and they order to clean it up. And in the 30s, we have this new, beautiful, fancy shuk. For a while, it went into real decline. Today, the shuk is experiencing a renaissance. And besides all of the merchants, among them, when I first made this PowerPoint, he wasn't Alav HaShalom. Today, he is. Uzi Uzieli, who was the etrog man of the shuk. Besides all the stores today, there are restaurants, there are bars, but you can still find a mincha in the shuk. And one of the parts of the renaissance of the shuk is the graffiti shutters. There's an artist named Solomon Souza. About 10 years ago, he started approaching the stall owners, and he said, "You know, at night you roll down your shutters; they're very ugly. Would you mind if I painted on them?" And most people said yes, and it eventually became something that they ran after him. They wanted it. So some of them are famous, some of them are stall owners, some of them are just drawings that he liked. But you can go very early in the morning or very late at night and see the shutters that are there. And finally, one of the nice projects that the local council has done, two projects. One is called Portrait in Stone. And they asked people who lived in the neighborhood, who have ancestors in the neighborhood, to give in family photographs with information. And they created these beautiful, you just walk down the alleyways and you can see them all over the place. Some of them are famous people, most of them are not. And you see where people are from and what kind of families and how they dressed. And that's very interesting. The other project is a project of a French company called Cité de la Création. And they do these fabulous, like illusion pictures all over. And this is one of them on the edge of the shuk, showing the market and a falafel stand. And it's very nice. And Nachlaot is always reinventing itself. It definitely is a hippie heaven, with many, many interesting stores, communities, synagogues, very worth exploring in person. Let us see what questions we have here or comments. Questions and comments. All right, hold on. Let me go up to the beginning. Askeret Moshe. By his family lives there. Very nice. Yanina was famous for etrogim. Many Hasidim would only use etrogim from there under the dubious assumption that they were free of history of grafting. That's so interesting. I did not know that. Thank you. Okay, Sfaradim Torim, Yossi Bane, also the, well, today the Razel family, yes, lives in Nachlaot, and they are also singers, who are involved in, musical, creation in Yerushalayim. That is true. That's a nice update. Thank you. Anybody else? Comments, questions?
Yes. Those pictures, now, you would call those pictures Trump Leol.
Thank you. I never can pronounce those things well, so I
said Trump Loy is how it's pronounced.
I don't even try. Okay, so we are on for next week. Be'ezrat Hashem, we will be doing Mount Scopus. Very different stories, very different pictures. Thank you, everybody. Shira, I don't know if you have announcements.
Announcements, just working on the pre-Pesach program, so keep your eyes out for that. And thank you so much, Shuli. This was a nice walk.
Thank you.
Walk down memory lane from my old stomping grounds, my pre-married days. I lived in Napa.
Thank you.
Just the last question, is there active and effective historical building preservation society in Jerusalem? So since the abominations of the 60s and 70s, there is much more of an awareness of preservation, and there actually are some laws about it. But unfortunately, look, I don't want to say that there's no preservation, but there's a weird, like today what's being done is you're allowed to build these enormous skyscrapers as long as you preserve certain buildings, right? So buildings might be preserved. Are you preserving the character of the neighborhood? That's a very arguable thing, right? So I don't know about a buildings preservation society. There's definitely preservation societies all over the country. I don't know how active the Jerusalem one is, but it's definitely better than it used to be. Let's put it that way. All right. Thank you, everybody. Have a good week. Don't start cleaning for Pesach yet.
Thank you.
That was great.
Shabbat Tov.